Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Did you find something ancestral this past week? Hi, it's Fisher, and this is Extreme Genes, America's family history show, where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. All right, real short introduction this week because we have much ground to cover. This week, we've got guests on that shine the light on the two big research breakthroughs of the 21st century, DNA and digitized newspapers. First, we'll be talking to Bennett Greenspan, president of Family Tree DNA. Now, with Ancestry.com announcing they're dropping out of the Y chromosome and mitochondrial markets this past week, Family Tree DNA will, of course, be strengthened in those important areas. We'll hear from Bennett about his company in about 8 minutes. Then later in the show, you'll hear from a man who has digitized over 26 million pages of newspapers, mostly from around New York City and state. That's almost three times as much as the Library of Congress has done. Oh, and you can access them for free. He's got a great site and a great story. Well, earlier this week, I had the chance to talk to Maureen Carruthers Tate from River Rouge, Michigan. And did she get a great call recently concerning her father, who passed away over 50 years ago. Listen to this.
What an experience you've had recently with Father's Day coming up. It seems really appropriate. Your dad's World War II dog tag found in Wales. Tell us about this.
Well, I really don't know what to tell you about Wales because I've never been there. I was contacted through the Detroit Free Press in regards to his dog tags being found, and the individual that found them would like to return them to me. So I guess that's going to take place sometime in the future. And then when I get them, they will be given to my son, which is his grandson. He's a handicapped child, so mm-hmm. He'll be getting those. He never had a chance to meet his grandfather. So, I mean, that's the only right thing that I know to do.
Well, it sounds like a great thing to do. Tell us about that call. What was your reaction when you heard about this?
After I stopped crying, I was a little stunned because I really didn't expect it. After all these years, I really didn't think they were ever going to be found.
Brag about your dad a little bit. It's Father's Day weekend. Tell us about what your dad did for our country in World War II.
To be truthful, he didn't really talk a lot about it. He said he enlisted, went and did what he had to do, and he was trying to hurry up and get back home to marry my mother. So, that was one part of his life that he said he just really would rather just, as they say, hang it up on the back burner.
Yes, obviously everybody handles that differently. Some people can talk openly about it, and some people really struggle with it. Do I understand now that the dog tag was found in an area, though, that was a training ground for D-Day?
That's what I understand.
And so do you know for a fact if your father actually participated in that?
Yes, he did.
Oh, so you knew that much?
Yeah, I didn't know that much.
Tell us about what he told you about that.
Well, basically, you know, back in the day, their training exercises were quite different from what they are nowadays. And by him being somewhere that he had never been before, didn't know anybody, you know, with a strange group of people, they worked hard. And that was the best that he told me.
And then off he went to France, and he wound up in Europe.
Yeah, he did a little bit of traveling, a little bit everywhere. I guess that's where I get it from.
Now, tell us about the dog tag. Now, do you ever talk to Dad about this?
As far as his dog tags were concerned, I asked him where they were, and he said he didn't know he had lost them.
And now they're found. Now, where was it found in Wales, and what was the circumstance of that?
To my understanding, a gentleman and his daughter were walking, and I guess somebody had dug up the ground, and that's how they found them.
And it was sitting right there. And obviously a place where a lot of the soldiers had done the training. And how long ago did he find it, and how long did it take for him to find you?
Well, actually, I have not talked to the individual.
Okay.
They contacted London, and London contacted the Free Press, and the Free Press called my cousin, and my cousin gave them my number. That's how I was called. So there really isn't a plan set. All I know is that he wants to get them back to me.
And I bet you can't wait.
Yes and no.
Really?
You know how you have mixed feelings sometimes?
Does it bring a lot of negative back?
No, I know I'm just going to bust out and cry. That's all.
is that a bad thing, Maureen?
For me, yeah, because once I get started, I don't stop.
Uh-oh. Well, it's a beautiful thing. Obviously, you were very close to your father, and it's going to be a great thing for you to have in your possession, and I'm sure your son is going to treasure that and value that connection to the past.
I hope so.
Well, Maureen, thank you so much for your time, and congratulations on an amazing experience, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Well, I hope Maureen has that good long cry soon. And coming up next, he's the president and founder of Family Tree DNA, the largest such company in the world. Bennett Greenspan joins us in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, the radio root sleuth with Bennett Greenspan, my guest. He's the president of Family Tree DNA. Bennett, welcome to Extreme Genes. Nice to have you on and nice to meet you.
Well, Scott, nice to be on the show, and I'm looking forward to having a chance to chat with you and perhaps shed a little light on genetic genealogy for your listeners.
You know, when we hear the term genetic genealogy, it sounds scientific and sterile. And, you know, the reality of it is, though, it brings about miraculous things and knowledge within families. And I'm going to tell you about a friend of mine that used Family Tree DNA not long ago. He's a young guy, didn't have a lot of money. You had a special deal going on out there for like $40, and he did an autosomal DNA test through you because his grandfather had been adopted, never knew who the father was, and they suspected it might be some unique ethnicity for the area that he had come from in the West. The test came back. He matched somebody in the Washington area and found out Middle Eastern. The two sides met. They both found that they came from the same area, that they were actually cousins. And so we had this big family reunion that my wife and I were actually invited to last summer. And it was a miracle thing, an amazing thing. And now they know where they're from, that they were actually from part of Israel, this branch of the family. And it was a very unique experience.
Well, what a wonderful story. You know, we have an opportunity to hear those stories. And because we have such a large reach in the genealogical and in the adoption market, we hear stories like that frequently. In fact, I was just at a genealogical convention in California, and someone came up to me and said, I just want to introduce you to someone who was adopted who has enough DNA in common with me and on my father's side that we clearly know how this person is now related to us. And if it wasn't for DNA, we never would have had an idea.
It is one of what I think the two greatest innovations in family history here in the last decade or this century, that and digitized newspapers. And the combination is just so powerful. But let's talk about Family Tree DNA. Give us a little history of it for people not familiar with what it is and how you guys started this thing.
Well, interestingly, I am not approaching genetic genealogy as a scientist. I'm approaching genetic genealogy as a genealogist. I've been a genealogist since I was a boy. I drew my first family tree in 1965, and I had picked up and put down my genealogy many times over the next three decades because every time I hit a paper trail roadblock, I kind of gave up on that line. And so in 1999, I researched the line of my mother's mother's father. And after I had done the research and found all the cousins here in the United States, I entered the name into a database and I found someone living in Buenos Aires, Argentina, who claimed to come from the same ancestral village that my mother's mother's father's family had come from. They had the same last name. They claimed to come from the same village. They claimed to have relatives in the United States. We knew nothing about relatives down there. And so I ended up convincing the folks at the University of Arizona to act, in effect, as a laboratory, and I would act as the front end, and we would do DNA testing and offer it to the general genealogical community. And we only did that after I got the results of a pilot back, which in effect showed that those folks in Argentina were related to my relatives living in the United States. And so, in effect, I was the first customer of the company. And the reason I started the company is because I saw such tremendous potential for us genealogists who got paper trail roadblock that I wanted to, in effect, give something back to the community. But I will admit to you, Scott, it has grown far beyond my expectations. I just smile when I go to these conferences and everyone's talking about DNA because I remember the time when no one wanted to talk to me about using DNA and genealogy, and that has absolutely turned 180 degrees since we formally started the company in May of 2000. And since that time, by the way, between our own testing efforts and between the testing efforts of our affiliates, including the National Geographic Society's Genographic Project, our company has processed over 1 million DNA samples in our laboratory.
Wow. Isn't that something? And, you know, you think about that. You were talking about the 180-degree turn. There are still people out there going, I don't know that I want to give my spit because the government's going to be able to track me. And but obviously, that has never been the case. The privacy of this and the use of this particular DNA is very unique to this particular application.
Well, Scott, not only is that correct, but if the government wants your DNA, they're not going to waste their time coming to a commercial company that does DNA testing. They're going to come directly to your house, and they're going to ask for your cooperation, and they're going to ask if they can come inside, sit down, and talk to you. And at that point, you really should be concerned. But at this point,
or they're going to get that Coke can you threw away on the way down the street.
But see, with our customers, there's no legal chain of custody, which is absolutely required in anything that is used by any of our, you know, police authorities. So they want to come in, they want to watch you scrape, they want to scrape you, they want to take it back to the lab and do whatever they want to do. We don't do any of those things. We send you out a scraping kit. You scrape in the privacy of your own home. You claim who you are, and then you send back the sample. The good thing for us is that most genealogists just want to discover the truth, whether it's on the Y chromosome, the mitochondria, which is the mother's mother's line, or using the autosomal DNA, which casts a different type of very wide net. And so this is really a tool for genealogists to break through brick walls and to find out things about themselves that they couldn't otherwise determine by looking in a mirror.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about now the progress and the changes that are happening. Autosomal is really a pretty recent thing, and a lot of people wonder, well, what does that mean? And it's really, like you said, it's not just the male line and the female line. It's everything in between, and it's, what, 700,000-plus points that you test?
Right. We use what's called a microarray, which has 700,000 discrete data points on it, covering all of your 22 chromosomes that recombine, plus the X chromosome. And we use that to predict degrees of relatedness. So I can tell two people if they are first cousins or if they're one-half first cousins. And how does someone end up as a one-half first cousin? That means that they don't share quite as many grandparents in common as they thought they did. Sometimes that happens because a man will get divorced and then get remarried and have children with that second wife, or there's a non-paternal event, which means that there was a surprise in the genealogy, and we can determine if that's the case. We regularly get contacted by multiple girls who want to know if they all share the same father. Quite often, people who think they are half-brothers or a brother and a sister who will think that they are half-sibs will contact us. Lots and lots of adoptees are adopting the technology of DNA testing, and in particular, they're using autosomal DNA testing to try to cast a very wide net to find relatives. And then we also have the ability to tell an individual what their ethnic percentages are by using the autosomal DNA test. So I can tell if someone is 8% Native American, 12% Sub-Saharan African, and 80% European, or any combination thereof from regions around the entire world. So one way that we use that test right now is we're determining whether Amer Asians, little kids who were fathered by USGIs in Vietnam and then came to the United States on what was called Operation Baby Lift in the 1970s, those kids are looking for their biological parents, their mom back in Vietnam, and maybe their USGI service dad here in the United States. And we have actually been able to put together a number of kids who have been living in the United States for you know, since 1975, and we've been able to introduce them to their GI service dads that they never knew, and the dads never knew. In many cases, the dads didn't know that they had gotten a Vietnamese woman pregnant. The child was born, the GI went back to the United States, developed a life, and surprise. So we deal with a lot of those kinds of cases. But of course, our bread and butter, our standard business is the Y chromosome and the female mitochondria, which we have pioneered the testing of and have offered to the genealogical community for surname projects for the past 14 years. We probably have a surname project for the top 10,000 surnames in the United States.
It's unbelievable. And I'm part of one of those and have found it to be very useful. And then back on the autosomal thing, you know, we talked about the half cousins. I found a guy who is my half second cousin. The autosomal test actually showed us as being somewhere around a fourth cousin. But I'm thinking because there are varying degrees, right, that come back down. Is that how that works?
Yeah, the point is that there is a range of the amount of DNA that would typically flow from one generation to the next and then on to subsequent generations. So when we look at the DNA, there's certainly a range where someone might be a first cousin or might be a second cousin, and we'll try to pigeonhole them. But there's another issue that I want to mention, and that's that most of us are a little bit more closely related to our cousins than we realize. And that's because if we go back five generations, most of us don't actually have 64 unique great-great-great-grandparents. I'll give you an example. One individual we predicted as a fourth cousin, and he said, you know, I know all my fourth cousins. And he said, I don't think this is right. Well, he called me back about a week later and said, okay, I have to tell you the truth. I figured out that guy that you predicted is a fourth cousin. He's a double cousin with me. He's a fifth cousin and a seventh cousin. But that's pretty common for lots and lots of us.
That's right. Bennett, we are out of time. Thank you so much. I wish we could go on for another half hour. This is so great. He's Bennett Greenspan. He is the president of FamilyTreeDNA.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Next, we focus on the second great breakthrough of the century, digitized newspapers. We'll talk to a man who's given us over 26 million digitized pages for free in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And this is the first time I've actually got to talk to one of my genealogical heroes. He's a man who has put together a website of digitized newspapers that is bigger than that of the Library of Congress. And he's done it all by himself with no sponsorships, no ads on his site, no memberships. Tom Trinitsky, it is a pleasure and an honor to meet you. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you.
The site is called FultonHistory.com. If you go there, it's kind of, I would say it's artistic, Tom. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it is.
It has bubbles and fish and old-time radio shows on there, and it kind of hides the fact that the reality is there is more information on New York State than is probably on any other site you can think of. When did you start this thing, Tom, and why?
Well, actually, I started it probably in the late 1990s. I retired very early at 49, and I basically started with a box of old Fulton, New York postcards that was loaned to me by a fellow worker.
From Fulton County, New York? Is that what you're saying?
No, this was Fulton, New York.
Fulton, New York.
Which is in Oswego County.
Okay.
And those postcards depicted Fulton back in its heyday. It was a very, very busy town. You can get a job anywhere as you wanted. And the way the lawns were kept and the people kept their houses, it was phenomenal. And obviously, Fulton has gone through some hard times as of late. And these old postcards, I wanted to share them with people and didn't really know how about going about doing it. So I come up with the idea of putting up a real simple website. I guess my first name at that time was called Old Fulton, NY, New York.ru. .da. Yeah, I know it's a little strange.
Yeah,
but
yeah, we'll all remember that.
Yeah, I know it. And anyhow, I put the postcards up and mentioned it around Fulton, you know, and people got a really good kick out of that because, again, a lot of these people now never knew Fulton back in that day.
Sure.
Really showed, you know, a lot of interest. So then I branched into newspaper scanning. And I scanned the local newspapers, Swiggle Valley News, which was on a tabloid-sized scanner. And it took me just about a year to do the whole run. And I did one page at a time, and while I was scanning it, I was reading the next page. So it was very interesting. That newspaper was what we call very photo-rich, and it would take pictures of birthdays, graduations, retirements, you name it, full of photos. And at that time, I was just getting into word recognition, and I had tried a bunch of programs. And I said, well, let's see how that works with the newspaper. And I was amazed at the quality I was getting out of the scans and the word recognition.
Yes.
I put the website up and started doing the newspaper and got around town, and people were just floored by putting a key word out there, and also they see a
yes.
picture of themselves, graduation or retirement or what have you. And it kind of really took off at that point. As time go on, I wanted to add more newspapers, but the newspapers that I wanted to add were bigger than the tabloid scanner I had. And at that point, I realized if I was going to stay doing this, I had to go out and buy a microfilm scanner. And I wanted to see how it handled the quality of the microfilm that I get, which is usually very poor.
Right.
I work generally with just what we call service copies. It, you know, it's usually, I call it also the bottom of the barrel microfilm.
Now, where do you get these things? The number of papers you have more than the Library of Congress. You have more than pretty much all the major companies have out there. Obviously, you got a big start on it. What are you at, 26 million pages now?
I have, right now, even though the site says 26,800,000, I'm way over that because I just don't do an update every time I get a new run of newspapers. So,
well, let me ask you this. Are there more papers from New York City to come?
Yes. I am looking at adding a couple of the big runs, and I just been see what the availability of it. That's one of the big things that I try to do is I got to contact these various libraries that have it and see if they'll let me borrow it. And, you know, as part of the deal is, if they let me borrow it, I give them a complete digital copy of it for their use, you know, if they want to use it for.
Sure.
And that's a good deal, I think, for me and them because
totally.
For them to go out and have that done.
I think that's how most people do it now, right?
Yep, that's right.
Well, tell me some stories, Tom, about people and their discoveries that have touched your heart and made you feel good about what you've done.
I get these all the time. These people will they'll come onto my site and they'll do a search not thinking they're going to get nothing. Because, again, even though I'm heavily into New York State newspapers, New York State newspapers also included information from other newspapers across the United States because they used the wire to use it as fillers on their newspaper.
Yes.
And they'll come in and type in a keyword, and all of a sudden it pops up in a New York State newspaper about something that they never dreamed would be there. And, you know, I always get these things. You know, I never knew anything about my family, about what they did. They never talked about this particular great-grandfather or something, and now I know why, because he found out that this guy might have been in jail or murdered somebody. You know, it's just things like that that pop up that you just never knew you would be able to find out anything about it.
Well, and I'll tell you that one of the things that you printed that nobody else has gave me the name of a third great-grandfather I'd been looking for 30 years. And
wow.
I was able to match his burial information from the newspaper with the grave in Brooklyn, New York. Found he was buried with a previously unknown daughter of a great-grandmother of mine, which basically proved that he was the right guy.
Yeah.
And then his presence proved who she was. So I wouldn't have found one without the other. That got me back into Connecticut, and ultimately that line took me back to the Mayflower. And that's because
wow.
of what you'd done.
Wow. Yeah, I get that type of information all the time from people. And, you know, that's probably I get the most kick out of. Hearing those stories, I said, my God, this is great, you know. So, I mean, things like that which keep me going on this. As you know, I don't make any money on these projects, but I sure do like hearing these stories.
Well, now tell me why it is you haven't commercialized this. It is free to everybody. We need to tell them the address right. It is FultonHistory.com.
Right.
And you mentioned New York State probably because you think of that first because you live there. anywhere, but you have the greatest collection of New York City newspapers anywhere. And so many Americans come through New York City. They may find what they're looking for there. But why not commercialize it? Why is it you haven't pursued a dollar on this thing, not even ads on your site, Tom?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people enjoy the site as it is free because, quite frankly, they can't afford the pay sites.
Right.
And, you know, I don't want to penalize somebody just because they haven't got a few dollars in their pocket from, you know, accessing this information. Again, I do accept donations, and I think that's the best way to do it. People then that can afford it do make a donation. People that cannot afford it, they don't. I mean, that's kind of like the way it is.
And that's basically just to cover your costs, because you're not making anything from this.
No, I mean, it doesn't, I'll be honest with you, it doesn't even cover my costs. My running costs alone for the broadband is over $600 a month. I don't make anything near that per month.
It's just your passion.
Absolutely. Again, I retired early, and I was not the type of guy to ever just sit around and do nothing. Believe me, this takes up a lot of my time.
Oh, there's no question, and we can see that. Well, it's a great service, perhaps the greatest single service of any individual in America right now, on behalf of those people who have New York ancestry, and maybe, as you mentioned, from several other places. So thank you so much for what you do, Tom. Long life and good health that you can keep this thing going. And once again, it is FultonHistory.com. How many pages do you think you're up to? You say it's not 26.8 million anymore. It's way beyond that.
I would say 27 million, maybe 300,000 right now. Again, I'm going to have another update in the fall, and, you know, we'll see how far along I am.
We're almost triple the Library of Congress's efforts, all by yourself. Amazing.
Well, the Library of Congress has a lot of bureaucracy around it, so, I mean, things take time when they do things, and I can understand that.
Well, I'm sure they look at you with raised eyebrows. He's Tom Trinisky. He's the founder of FultonHistory.com. Thanks so much for joining us, Tom.
Okay, thank you very much.
And coming up next, Tom Perry, our preservation authority, answering your questions on Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes, Family History Radio. It's America's Family History Show. I am Fisher with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority. Welcome back, Tom. Good to see you.
Good to be back.
Oh, you're sounding better this week.
A little bit, but I still am as ugly as ever.
Well, we've been getting questions about various things dealing with legalities. For instance, with a family reunion, can you show a movie at a family reunion?
Absolutely not.
Really? So you can't go rent a movie and then show it in front of the gang, even though you're not going to make any money off of that.
Right. You can't do that. As silly as this may sound to people, that's why a lot of the larger churches in the old days, they used to have, like, get a group of their kids together and show movies. They don't do that anymore because it is actually copyright violation. You have to get a permit. Like, a lot of cities have movie nights. We have one in our neighborhood. They have it at different libraries out on their lawn and such. But there's a company you can get a hold of and pay royalty fees, and they can be anywhere from $250 to $1,000 for the movie, depending exactly what you're going to do. If you're a nonprofit organization, which a family reunion would qualify as, if you're showing a movie that's now presently in the theaters, if it's one that's just left the theaters, there's so many different options. And if you want to really go by the letter of the law, that's the way to do it. A lot of times people just do it and don't worry about it. But you got to be careful that if you're advertising stuff on the internet, that you're doing things and you're going to show some movie or something, somebody might see that and can come after you and can fine you. And the fines are a lot higher than paying up front. And like I say, you can do these usually from about $200 to $1,000, depending what movie you're getting. But you can get movies that are actually in the theaters right now and have the rights to show them at a reunion or at the park or to your neighborhood or whatever. But legally, you can only play DVDs and VHS in your home for your family. Same thing. In fact, the law actually states if you record in the old days onto a VHS tape, a movie, you can watch it, but it actually has to be played on the VCR that you recorded it on.
Wow.
We have people come in all the time and say, hey, I recorded this stuff off the television I want to keep. Can you take the commercials out? And absolutely not. We cannot. We can't do any changes to it whatsoever, or we would be in copyright violation. That does not fall under the Fair Use Act.
All right.
If you're going to have something as large as a family reunion, I really suggest you get a hold of one of these companies. You can just Google them, and you can pay as little as $250. And on most family reunion budgets, $250 isn't a lot of money. So as we have families come to our reunion center, we'll be the same way. If they want a Harry Potter movie or they want any kind of movie, then we can just pay the subscription price that they'll charge, and then we can show it. And the neat thing is that you don't have to go to Netflix and get it. They will send you, you know, a high-resolution copy of it that you watch. And a neat thing, too, for another fee, and I don't know exactly how much it is, you can get an edited version or what we call an airplane version, which doesn't have some of the profanity, some of maybe there's a movie you really want to watch, but there's too much violence in it. Movies like that, you can have them edit for you, which you can't do yourself, but they'll do it for you. Say, hey, I wanted the edited version. I want this R-rated movie to be PG-13 or even PG, and they will do that for you.
Now, similarly, we got music, right, that people often want to use on videos they put together for things like family reunions.
Exactly.
And that is obviously against the law.
Oh, absolutely. No question about that. Let me have you write this down. Anybody that's out there that wants to check on audio rights, there's a place called harryfox.com, which is HarryFox.com. He handles all the mechanical licensing. When you go to the site, just click on what's called song file. And that's for the small companies or the small families that might want to make a disc that they want to hand out at a wedding or that they want to put on their family reunion video. And you can buy the licensing rights. And this is if you're going to distribute less than 2,500. So unless you got a real big family, like we talked a few weeks ago about this big convention that's going back east, you know, you would fall under that. Check it. Tell them what songs you want. You can find, wow, this song's $1,000. This song's only $5. Let's do some $5 ones. And that way you're totally legal. Any way you want to distribute it, as long as you fall within those guidelines, you'll be able to do that. You feel good about it. You can advertise on the internet, do whatever you want, and you're totally covered.
Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, our preservation authority. And Tom, we've been hearing from people still with some confusion over specific things that we can and can't do, things we want to obviously avoid getting us in trouble over. Where do you want to start?
Okay, what you can do, you can take an old vinyl record or an audio cassette that you own that is not available on a CD and convert it to a CD. That's legal. You can't make additional copies, but you can do that. That's called a convenience use and falls under the Fair Use Act. With videotape, same thing. If you have a copyright videotape that is not available on DVD or Blu-ray, you can transfer it to one DVD if you own it, but you can't distribute it or make copies for your kids or backup copies, anything. You can do one. The things you cannot do, you cannot go and check out a cassette from the library or check out a DVD from the library and make a copy of it. That's major copyright infringement. That's what I call stealing.
That's right.
The royalties aren't going to the artist that created it, all the distributors, all the people. I made a list, which we don't have time to go over, that's got 50 names of it that people you're stealing from if you borrow somebody's CD and download it on your MP3 player, for instance.
Well, you can go through the musicians who played.
Exactly.
The people who wrote the song.
Uh-huh.
The music arranger. You've got the music companies, the distribution people, right? All
right.
These people.
Yeah, the store themselves. Even the people that are lumberjacks that cut down the trees that turn into the paper, that turn into the tray cards or inside the thing. There's so many people whose livelihood depends on people being honest. Now, a lot of CDs, you can go and read the fine print, and it will tell you you can put this on your own devices. So if you have an iPhone, a computer, MP3 player, you can put it on all of those things. That's fine. Sometimes you can buy a family license, which means you can put on your kids' MP3 players and iPods and such. And some of them you can't. Just read the fine print, then you know, hey, this will allow me. Same thing with computer software. Sometimes you can buy a family license, which you can put on 4, 5, 6 computers and things at your home.
And, you know, for a comparison, Tom, earlier, I think it was last year, we talked about people who went out and had their family portraits done and then discovered their family portraits were being used commercially overseas.
Exactly.
So, you know, it can be the other way around. And how would we feel about that? And you actually knew somebody that happened to.
Yeah, we had a customer that actually came into our store that said that they were shopping at IKEA and they went and saw one of their neighbor's pictures on a table, kind of dressing up the place. And they thought that was so cool. So they called her from the phone and said, hey, you know, hey, this is so cool. When did you guys start doing modeling and stuff? And they're going, excuse me? So they jumped in their car, ran down to IKEA and saw it, went to the manager. The manager immediately removed it and found out that the place that they were buying what they call clip art from had that picture. And they said, well, how did you get it? There are some companies out there where you can do storybooks online. And if you read the fine print, it says you have exclusive rights to do whatever you want with this. However, we have non-exclusive rights that we can sell your pictures or do whatever we want as well. And people don't read the fine print. And so somebody uploaded a really cool picture that somebody wanted at IKEA. So they sold it to them. They used it. And so IKEA has changed their policy now. They don't buy from this company anymore. They only buy from ones where they are actually hired models. So IKEA did the right thing. They didn't have to. They were totally within the law, but they did the right thing. So how would you feel if you see your picture in some hemorrhoid commercial or something like that?
Well, Tom, you've made a great case for reading the fine print that none of us do, and you do this regularly,
absolutely,
obviously because you're looking to protect your own business, but I think that would apply to all of us who are looking to make sure we stay out of trouble, even when we're sharing things that are relating with the family, or we're trying to put music to a family video, whatever it is, we got to be careful we do it right. And if you have a question for Tom, all you have to do is ask Tom at tmcplace.com, and you might hear your question answered on the air. Thanks for coming in, Tom.
Good to be here.
And thanks so much to Bennett Greenspan, president of FamilyTreeDNA.com, for coming on the show and talking about that. And Tom Treniski, he's the founder of FultonHistory.com, digitized newspapers. I mean, he has virtually all of New York locked up, and it's there for you free to access. If you missed those segments, of course, catch the podcast. You can get them on iTunes and iHeartRadio and ExtremeJeans.com. And be sure to download our free podcast app for your iPhones and Androids. Talk to you next week. Have a great one. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Jeans on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.